Welcome to the Onyx Pathcast. My name is Matthew Dawkins, and I am accompanied here today with my colleagues, Eddie Webb.
Hello.
And Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
The two of them will receive fuller introductions in due course, but for the time being, I think I will introduce what this podcast is, why you're here. I hadn't hoped to know why you're here, what we're about, what is an onyx path, where does it go, how do you walk down one? All these questions and more will maybe be answered. Possibly. I don't know.
In the next 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah, in the next 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll wrap up, we'll have a nice sing-song, go down the pub. To be honest, most of what we're doing today is free form. There's very little structure. I mean, that pretty much describes most of my days, and so it means this podcast is a seamless part of it, and hopefully that is the same for my fellow hosts. Now, what are we going to be talking about on the Onyx Pathcast? Well, primarily, we'll be talking about Onyx Path's products, our working practices, the people that work here, some of our stories of how we got into the industry, the games we love, the games we hate, our various pet peeves and foibles regarding gaming, basically our impressions of the industry. And the three permanent hosts of this podcast will be myself, Eddie, and Dixie. But we will also have guests on from time to time. Some of them will be from our Onyx Path stable. Some, however, will be from outside of the world of Onyx Path. We will interview people who are past hands from White Wolf and maybe existing hands at White Wolf. We'll interview people from all over the industry spectrum as far as we can find them and as long as they agree to come on and we don't have to chain them up and drag them here. But, you know, if we have to do that...
Also the problem with our sons.
Yeah, if we have to do that, it will make for an interesting podcast. So the first guest will actually be... You know, please, let me out! The first guest that we're intending on having on our podcast is Megan Fitzgerald, who is the developer of Changing the Lost, second edition, and has also worked on several Exalted books, Contagion Chronicle, has worked on a whole slew of products that Onyx Path has produced. And that won't be this episode, it will be the next one, but that will hopefully be something for you to look forward to. So we do have quite the schedule ahead of us. And what we want is for a certain degree of interaction. We want the fans, the listeners, if you don't want to be considered a fan, that's absolutely fine. We want the listeners...
If you hate us, still listen.
Well, you know, you might. And that's the funny thing, isn't it? A lot of people, some people, the vocal minority, as we like to call them, like to read our books and say, I hate this, this is trash, you've ruined gaming, but I'm going to read it anyway. And maybe that's a topic.
And that... Thanks for buying our books, yeah. I guess.
But your opinion is, of course, valid and welcomed. And we value your hatred. But anyway...
It makes us stronger!
Anyway, we'll move on from this, because that in itself seems like the topic for a podcast in the future. How do we handle, haters? Do we handle haters? Do we just ignore them? Do we throw them overboard? There's all kinds of plans for these people, but we won't get to them just yet.
That sounds extremely ominous. We have plans for
ominous
all of you.
Is appropriate for Onyx Path, I think, given that the majority of our trade and fare is in horror role-playing games, although not all, we should have some ominous plans in our back pocket and some in our front pocket as well. Our first show, we have a coat of many pockets. I believe it's a Pathfinder or Dungeons & Dragons item of some worth. But for our first show, we thought we'd take an informal approach. We're just laying down structure. We're kind of getting to know each other. The three of us haven't worked together for terribly long in any formal capacity. And so this is going to be an introduction not only to the podcast itself, but also to the hosts. And I'll start. In fact, I'll pass over to Eddie very shortly without trying to make a big formal exchange of relay batons as to what an Onyx Path is. What is Onyx Path Publishing? Likelihood is, if you stumbled upon this podcast, you already know, because you didn't stumble upon it. You saw us advertise it, you downloaded it, and you're listening to it. It's very rare for someone to just go for episode one when no other episodes exist, unless they're an existing fan of the person producing the product. But that doesn't mean you haven't stumbled upon it later. So what is an Onyx Path? Eddie, I would like for you, if you could, if you have your tome of history to hand, to give us a potted history, which will no doubt receive coverage and expansion as the series goes on. What is Onyx Path Publishing?
It's actually incredibly interesting, but we'll try to kind of keep it short. Rich and I were working at White Wolf Publishing, Merger CCP, and we then Rich created Onyx Path as a spinoff company to license those some tabletop properties from White Wolf. So really, Onyx Path is a combination of a spiritual successor of the original White Wolf Publishing, and also a completely new company, because not only are we taking on these established licenses and making new products in the World of Darkness and the Chronicles, Darkness Exalted, but also trying new things that didn't quite work in the previous company we're in. So it's, you know, a little bit of established cachet, and also a little bit of kind of an indie company, because we are small. I mean, you know, a lot of us are contractors. There are very few full-time employees, and we're all distributed all over the world. So it's organized and structured a lot closer to an indie company than, you know, an established tabletop RPG company, like, say, in the 90s or the early aughts.
I'm going to cut in there a sec, mm-hmm. Eddie, if I may.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting, the terminology of indie company, it's something that gets thrown around quite a lot these days. It was especially thrown around, I guess, when D20 was at its peak.
Yeah.
Because, to differentiate the Goliaths of Wizards of the Coast, and I guess you could argue companies like White Wolf and Chaosium and so on. And it's strange, isn't it? Onyx Path very rarely gets considered as an indie company by the industry at large,
yep.
despite our size. And how do you know off the top of your head how many full-time employees Onyx Path retains?
Three, not counting Rich.
Yeah. So, and we don't have our own warehouse, do we?
No.
We have nothing
we have
like that.
No warehouse, no office space. We all just work from home. Yeah. Or coffee shops or bars.
Right.
So there you go. It's not too much of a hipster millennial beta. I'm using all the keywords now. I'm using the buzzwords. This will bring people in.
Buzzword this
trust up. Trust me. This will bring in the listeners. It's not too much of a reach to say that we are an indie company. And I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
No, and in fact, I've actually I've argued this sometimes specifically on the internet, but occasionally we'll get the Onyx Path isn't indie, some of those other companies indie, and a lot of the examples that people bring up, Onyx Path actually comes pretty close to them by the metrics they're using. One in particular that's interesting is Evil Hat Games. I love Fred's work. I love Evil Hat's work. Rich and Fred and all of us, we all get along great with each other, just, you know, working different parts of the industry. But a lot of times people think of Evil Hat as indie. But a lot of the metrics people use to define that, and they're personal to individual people, Onyx Path generally measures up. I personally find the term is only useful currently in the sense of we are not an established company that, like you said, has dedicated office space and the like. In that sense, most RPG companies are indie, to my mind. But that's drawing primarily from the video game interpretations of the word. Because in video games, it's kind of the delineation is this is a small group of people working remotely or on a very small budget to produce something, and which, again, is most of the RPG industry. But Onyx Path does kind of, in a sense of, you know, we're making our own games. We're trying to try new ways of structuring it and developing games. There's certainly a strong traditional approach in terms of our design. So, I mean, you know, we don't have as much indie design ethic as other people do. And again, that's another, indie design is becoming increasingly muddy as a concept. But in terms of just putting it together, I mean, it's really Rich is not only the boss, but also he's our creative director. So, I mean, it comes down to Rich has a very strong vision for what he wants to do with Onyx Path. A lot of what is Onyx Path really comes down to Rich Thomas. We're drawing inspiration from him, and he's, you know, we've all had experiences of chatting with Rich and having great discussions with him. And sometimes he's, you know, happy to bring on other viewpoints, but really Rich is the person that draws companies. So when you have the kind of the central creative figurehead that also drives the business, that's pretty indie to me.
Yeah. You know what? I think that pretty much explains what we do as a company and the way we're structured as a company. But Dixie, maybe you, because you've not had much chance to speak over my blustery tones, maybe you'd be happy to explain exactly what we publish, because we've not really spoken much about the games we release.
Yeah, totally. So Onyx Path has a bunch of different kind of branches. And the three of us are all in charge of different branches on some level. So the main one I think a lot of people know us for would be publishing the classic World of Darkness books, as they're referred to. So it would be things like Mage 20th Anniversary, Changeling 20th Anniversary, Vampire 20th Anniversary, and other iterations of those lines. And yes, there are more. I'm not going to sit here and list them all. That's incredibly boring to listen to.
Oh my god, that'd be a lot.
We also publish the Chronicles of Darkness lines, which used to be called New World of Darkness. That's Vampire the Requiem and Mage the Awakening, etc. Ascension. I get those mixed up every time.
It's because
every time. Why are they both A's? Every time. Yeah, every single time. I'm like, I've been doing this for years. Anyway. Anyhow, yeah, so we do those, and then we also have a couple other games we license from White Wolf, like Exalted, and then we have a few creator-owned games, like Pugmire, Cavaliers of Mars, and the forthcoming that came from Beneath the Sea. So, mm-hmm. We have kind of a large stable of games, everything from Scarredlands, which is Pathfinder and D&D 5e, all the way to the, you know, Vampire the Masquerade that everybody knows and loves.
Yeah, we certainly have a full plate of game genres, and I mentioned earlier, obviously, we're often seen as a horror game publisher, I guess, and that's right. that's to be expected due to the popularity of the World of Darkness and the Chronicles of Darkness. But with games like, well, Pugmire, I think, which is Eddie's game, is Eddie's baby, and so is Monarchies of Mao, which has been kickstarted, but mm-hmm. is also forthcoming. For publication, and not that far away. It would be quite a leap to say that those two were horror games, wouldn't you? Give them a brief description, Eddie? Both those games, because they're two of our biggest hitters of late, and I've got to go and answer my front door.
Again?
I very much appreciate that transition. Not at all awkward. Pugmire and Mao are basically two sides of the same kind of coin, in the sense that it's far in the future. Humanity has gone, and dogs and cats have been left behind. So it's kind of Lord of the Rings meets Planet of the Apes, but with dogs and cats. Pugmire is the dog version of the game. Monarchies of Mao is the cat version of the game. They're both separate, distinct games. One thing that was very important for me is that I wanted the games to have depth. I wanted the games to have a lot of things that people can play with and a strong background and concept, because that's something that Onyx Path games are known for. Is that kind of depth of experience. But I wanted to not necessarily make it horrific. I make it horrible. There's room for horror inside of both Pugmire and Monarchies of Mao. But generally, they kind of skew towards a lighthearted. There's definitely a stronger sense of humor in the game. It's not a funny game, but it is a game that has a sense of humor in it.
Yeah.
And also just there's a lot of... I took it as a challenge because I wanted to find a way to give depth and emotional strength to a game that doesn't involve making things everything horrible.
Yeah, I mean, I've found with the Pugmire games that I've both observed and run is that even if you're throwing kind of scary things at the players, there tend to be enough dog puns to keep the humor mm-hmm. going. And I'm sure the same thing will happen with Monarchies when that one is available for wide release, is that you can have a group of cats, you know, crawling in a scary dungeon with terrifying monsters after them, and someone's still going to make some joke about having 9 lives or landing on their feet or what have you.
Absolutely.
I was lucky enough to have my first Pugmire game at the first Gen Con I attended, and for Eddie to be lingering nearby. That was when you were doing your playtesting
yep.
And getting... you were actually going to the tables and asking the players like, their thoughts about this mechanic or that mechanic. And I think that was where I met Megan, speaking of...
Yeah, she was in that game too, wasn't she?
Yeah, and I've only just remembered that in recounting that. My character, Gustav von Doberman, won a prize in that game, if I remember correctly. But yeah, I'm a big fan of those, and I've worked on Monarchies and MAU, so it comes with a certain amount of bias. But they're such colourful, wonderful games, and you know, I know you definitely don't want them to be seen as children's games exclusively anyway, but I do think they're games that are accessible for a broader spectrum of the audience than some of our games, such as Vampire or Wraith or Promethean, for instance.
Right, and I think that it's actually kind of something that ties into what Island's Path is, to a certain extent, is when The World of Darkness first came out, there was a kind of an impetus to make the industry feel a little less childish, not childlike. And I find a distinction between those two terms.
Right.
And so it's like, you know, adults can have meaningful games. We can talk about adults, deeper topics. And so I think a lot of the impetus behind World of Darkness is to kind of push tabletop role-playing games in that direction. And in the 90s, that was definitely a necessary step. Now that we're 25 years later, I feel like a lot of the people who grew up with that have... You know, we've gotten older. A lot of us have families. The time is reduced. And so how can we take that desire to play deep, meaningful games and distill it down and also bring more people to the table? So, I mean, it's been useful over the past few years since Island's Path was formed. Rich has been fantastic at trying to deconstruct what White Wolf did well back when he worked at White Wolf, and apply it in new areas that aren't necessarily obvious. So it's like, you know, we don't have to do, everything doesn't have to be a dark game. We saw some glimmers of that near the end of the original White Wolf with, you know, games like Scion games like, you know, the Trinity Continuum, where it's like, you know, let's try to push this in new directions. But Onyx Path is kind of a natural evolution of that. And so now we can go even further and try even more things like, you know, Corsairs, fighting on the surface of Mars kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I've actually found that a lot with some of the games that we've been working on recently that are still coming out right now. Like I've recently edited both Trinity core books and both Scion core books. And it's a nice kind of halfway point where you could play an incredibly dark game if you wanted, but you could also just play a really kind of fun, more lighthearted game in either of those settings. Mm-hmm. Maybe not quite as lighthearted as Pugmire and Monarchies can get. But right. it's still there, and I know that with the game Matthew's working on right now, They Came From Beneath the Sea, it is horror, but it's very much, you know, 50s B-movie horror. So there's a lot of opportunity for that as well in your game, Matthew, is that correct?
Oh yeah, well, the idea behind They Came From, I've got a great love of 1950s B-movie sci-fi, and through to 60s, and there was less of it in the 70s, but it certainly existed. And that all comes from I have an uncle who just had a massive collection of American movies that were never released over here. I have no idea where he got them from, but I do know he had a massive satellite on in his front garden back when you had people with satellites just so they could tune into international broadcasts. No idea what his deal was.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, he had these this huge collection of sci-fi movies that every Saturday I would go over his house, play with my cousins, and we'd watch one of these dreadful movies. And at the time, they completely captivated me, just through wonder. I wasn't seeing the dreadful rubber costumes. I wasn't noticing the awful hammy dialogue or crap, frankly, special effects, and the same plot being trotted out over and over again. And not all of them were dreadful, mind you, but a lot of them happened to be. Now, I went back and rewatched a lot of these in the last few years, a lot of the films that I remember as being iconic, and they say things like, you should never meet your heroes, you should always move forward, and things like that. But I rewatched these movies, and as I started watching them, I went through a sort of series of emotions. It was like the stages of grief. Except at first I was watching one, and for the life of me, and just to fail my credentials here, I can't remember which, I was watching one, and about 15 minutes in I was thinking, this is trash. Why am I putting myself through this? I should, if I want to watch something funny, I'll watch Mystery Science Theater or watch a movie like this with riff tracks on. But I persevered with it, and I got about halfway through, and being a bit of a film snob, I started, I guess, critiquing the good stuff in it. I started thinking, okay, well, this works, and they're trying to say this about this, and I discovered various things, like a lot of these 50s sci-fi invasion movies are metaphors for the Cold War. It's fear of nuclear horror. A lot of this is about tests that have gone wrong, or there are characters who, if you particularly want to frame them in this way, are characters who act the way they do because they've served in war, in like the Second World War or in Korea. And so this guy doesn't trust anyone and lives out in the woods in a cabin. And the reason is because he's suffering from PTSD, although it's never actually labeled as such. And so behind this awful camp farcical edge, you have a depth of horror. And so with They Came From Beneath the Sea, you've got this game which can be played absolutely as a joke. You can play it to be complete comedy, and we don't prescribe what the comedy is in the game, because you should never try telling players what's funny, because they won't agree.
Yeah,
but you give them the tools to make a game funny for themselves. But at the same time, you've got a setting behind all of that where there's a zombie Joseph Stalin, and there's all kinds of weird and wonderful things going on in the world. And they can be as horrifying or as camp, again, as you choose. Because to use zombie Joseph Stalin as an example, yes, it's a ridiculous concept to have Stalin as a brain-eater eel-possessed zombie. But at the same time, if Stalin had lived for more years than he did, good God, that's awful for the world, because he was an awful human being and he did some terrible things. Right. So it's a game that can go one way or the other. And I think, again, it ties into what Eddie's talking about with the, I guess, multi-range approach of games like Pugmire and Monarchies of Mao. They can be as grim or as delightful as you like. And I owe a lot of my thinking on this subject to go outside of our Onyx Path sphere to Monty Cook Games. Monty Cook is another games developer, a gentleman, lovely guy, and one of his big mm-hmm. releases in the last few years was Numenera. And Numenera is you could classify it as a post-apocalyptic tabletop role-playing game. There's a video game attached to it, in fact, Torment, Tides of Numenera. Or you could describe it as a reconstruction post-apocalyptic role-playing game. because it isn't about characters living in fear of the environment and all the mysterious things that have happened to it to make all these anomalies and weird and wonderful contraptions that people don't understand pop up. It's about pioneers going out and not necessarily taming the wilderness, but understanding the world around them. And the same reason I'm drawn to that is the same reason I'm drawn to Pugmire. I love that idea. It's something fresh that we never really saw in post-apocalypse prior to this decade. It was always the grim survival of having to live in harsh environments. But now, with games like Pugmire and Monarchies of Mao and Numenera, you are going out into this world and you are making it better. If not just for yourself, you could have it for your community, or you could have it for the entire land around you. And that really speaks to me.
Yeah, I really like games that include a thread of hope. Both Pugmire and Monarchies, I think, have that, where it's post-apocalyptic, but there's, you know, hope for a better future. And I think that our game Cavaliers of Mars by Rose Bailey has that in droves, because I've described that game as pre-apocalyptic, because the whole point is that you're on Mars, and at some point Mars was settled, but now it's kind of dying. But the idea is that through the game, maybe you can fix it. Like, maybe you can make Mars better and make it not dying anymore, essentially. And I think having that thread of hope is really nice. It's something that a lot of old D&D campaigns always had, where, you know, you're pretty sure the heroes are going to win in the end. And then with horror gaming, a lot of times it's kind of the opposite. It's like, well, we're all doomed, so we might as well do what we want while we're being doomed. So I think having that thread of hope that you can play with or not as you choose is a really nice setting theme.
Well, which of our World of Darkness and Chronicles of Darkness games do you find the most hopeful, Dixie?
Gosh, probably... I'd definitely say Promethean, since the goal in Promethean is humanity. Eventually, and you can play Promethean Chronicle, where you're trying to contribute to one person's humanity, or you can play where you're all trying to achieve humanity. That's probably the main one. Also, Changeling the Lost, I think, has a lot of hope in it, because there is the idea that although it's horrible and you've escaped from the hedge and things are still maybe chasing you, you might get your life back in the end, even if you are changed. Those are probably the two that I would consider the most hopeful of the darkness lines.
Actually, to kind of build on that, I agree with you about Changeling the Lost, because a lot of the originally implicit theme, I think it's become more explicit over the years, is the idea of people who have suffered horrible events trying to rebuild their lives.
Right.
And so you have this idea of, we've escaped from the hedge, we've escaped from these horrible people in this horrible situation, and now trying to build a community for ourselves of people who have this shared experience. And because it's a Chronicles of Darkness game, naturally, that can skew to pretty dark and go into some of the problems of trying to build an entire society around surviving abuse, and some of the personality problems that come with that. But it is still, I think you're right, there's still a thread of hope there, because it is, like you said, with Pugmire and Monarchy's Mound, this idea of rebuilding, of trying to make something better from the ashes of what came before.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even in your histories of Pugmire and Monarchies, there's a lot of that kind of, like, there is a war that happened. And they're still trying to get past that. But also, at some point, humanity went away. We don't know why, we don't know how, but humanity went away. And so there's this, especially from Pugmire, I think there's this thread of hope that, like, someday we'll, you know, maybe find humanity again somehow, whether it's through records or actually finding them.
So an interesting thing that most people don't know is that that hope was not in the original pitch. The very first pitch I sent to Rich about the game was called The Fall of Pugmire.
Oh.
And the idea was that, because I was, at the time, thinking we had to play into this horror aesthetic. It's like, you know, when we make all these horror games, so I have to make a horror game. And so the idea was to take this hopeful world and watch it slowly fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And Rich is like, this is awful. It's like, you know, the poor kitties and doggies ever. Are getting hurt, you know? And I was just like, wait, what? This isn't what you want? And so we had a lot of conversations about that specific topic, and it slowly got shifted to melancholy, which I think is a much better place for it.
Yeah,
the idea of Good. Miss it. But I was like, just the idea that, you know, how animals will miss us while we're gone.
Yeah, like that melancholy is one thing. I definitely think that you don't want to write a whole game about horrible things happening to animals.
I feel like that's
not the direction you want to go with a lot of games. People are much more touchy about animal pain than they are about, you know, murdering 8,000 humans in a game of Vampire.
And that was actually something that I noticed was people who had been playing World of Darkness games, people who have been playing Chronicles of Darkness games, were giving me feedback during playtesting, like, can we have rules where these characters don't die?
Yeah.
I've had people say, I can't play Pugmire because I can't wrap my head around the idea of a dog getting hurt. And these, again, people who played through particularly horrible concepts through some of our other games. So people do kind of approach these games differently. And I think that kind of speaks to Omic's Path's strength is that we're able to kind of pull some of these experiences apart and offer different slices of high-level experience. And people can kind of go, oh, well, this is – I approach these games in a different way. Even though I enjoy playing Omic's Path games, there's not the quote-unquote one true way of playing all games.
That's something I'm doing with, of course, Pan's Guide for New Pioneers, which is a Pugmire sourcebook that I've developed and co-written. Should hopefully be coming out soonish. In fact, as of time of recording, I'm doing the second proof of it, so you never know. It might be out within the next couple of months. We will see.
Yay!
But it's something I was very keen on from the start of that, was this is an introductory adventure. I want this to be a bunch of players' launching pad for Pugmire, so let's say characters don't die. You know, there's partly a mechanical conceit there, because you want players to be able to get their characters through to the end of the adventure. But also, this particular adventure is better served with a little bit of whimsy. And although there are giant spiders and ants and other big beasties that want to devour you, it's far more likely they're going to paralyze you and scuttle off, giving you the chance to escape their web, which for me makes for a more fun game, especially if this is your intro scenario. Fair enough if you've been playing a character for several years and it's time for a noble end, then meet one. But if I'm playing an introductory scenario, I doubt I would have much fun having my character die just to show me this is what death is like in this role-playing game. But but I guess that differs, because it's funny you mentioning changing the Lost as well and the idea of hope with it, because I've got to be honest, I don't want to disagree with the two of you, but my experience I'll disagree with you, you're both wrong.
Go ahead.
My experience with it is quite, I guess, shaded with trauma, which has, of course, always been one massive angle of Changeling the Lost. It's that your characters have been through this trauma. That's understood. And while I can definitely see what you mean regarding hope being a big part of Changeling, most of the games in which I've been a player, at least, have been experiences where I've been hit over the head with trauma over and over again. You know, this is your life, it's dreadful, you know, aren't you suffering? And I know that isn't going to be everyone's style of play, and I hope it's not the majority's style of play in a way, but, you know, you play the games how you want to play them, listeners. You know, you don't have to listen to me. But I do hope that more people are getting hope out of Changeling and playing it to that angle. Not because I want it to necessarily be some grand uplifting experience, but because I think it's a very interesting angle to approach this game from, that isn't the, I guess, stereotypical way of playing Changeling the Lost, which is about having a bit of a miserable time. The first time I actually played it was in Seattle, and I was playing with a group. This is the first time I played with them. I was staying with some friends in Seattle after doing my hitchhike over America. And I got to Seattle to play Changeling. This wasn't the purpose of my my pilgrimage. But I was playing in an apartment with these people I've never played with before. And within the first hour, every player but me was in tears. And there was a part of me that thought, this is fantastic. I've got to know more about this game. And there was a part of me that thought, what are you doing to yourselves? I love any game that can evoke an emotional reaction. I truly do. And in a way, let's note this down as a topic to cover on a future podcast. It's RPGs that conjure up emotion from the players. But getting sorrow out of your players is a really strong gift to have in a game. But likewise, I think so is hope and optimism. If anything, I'd say those two are the hardest things to truly evoke, because it means your players are truly immersed in the game. If they are either genuinely joyful about their character's experiences or genuinely torn up over how dreadful they are.
I mean, isn't that one of the best things about role-playing games, is that every group is going to play differently, and you can play through the same module with a ton of different people and just have completely different experiences. I got to play in the 10-person LARP Inheritance at PAX Unplugged this past year. And I had the privilege of playing with Luke Crane, who wrote the game. And he ended up saying afterwards that he's played this, you know, hundreds of times, and no two times have gone the same. And also no group he's played with has ever ended it the way he thought it would end when he wrote it.
Interesting.
Yeah, because usually by the end of a game of Inheritance, most people are dead. That's just how it works. It's like a 3-hour, 10-person LARP. It has a fairly linear story, but within that linear story, there's a lot of room to play around with it.
Right.
And he made that comment that it's never ended the same. And like I've played vampire games where we were just running around murdering people, trying to solve mysteries, and I've played vampire games where we sat around and talked about politics for 3 hours. You know, like you can play however you want, and that's one thing I think is really cool about it. So if you want to play a hopeful trauma survivors coming together to find their own tribe and new family game of changeling, you can. And if you want to play a game where everybody is being constantly confronted with their traumas and it's incredibly emotional, you can play that too.
I also think that being able to shape what makes that game interesting to that experience can potentially be really, really resonant.
Yeah.
I was never a huge fan of Changeling the Dreaming for many years. I thought it was just kind of too colorful, too upbeat. You know, I didn't quite see what it was trying to do. It always felt like an odd duck to me in the World of Darkness. And then a friend of mine said, I want to run a Changeling Dreaming LARP. And I'm just like, oh, boy, here we go. But she was a good friend of mine. So she pitched it to me. And the idea actually resonated with me. Hang on a second. Someone's calling me. I will hang up on them.
Please turn your phones on silent during the podcast.
Yeah, that was my bad.
If it's someone in the industry, we can have an impromptu guest. You can say, hi, you're live on the
podcast.
That's fine.
That was my bad. The pitch was that it was a LARP that was only going to last for a year. And everyone was a senior in high school. And so the idea was to kind of play with this very Buffy the Vampire Slayer-esque background concept. And she's like, but you have to understand, as you're playing the game, in the back of your head, as soon as you graduate, you're done, you're out. You know, everything that you are doing now will no longer have meaning, because you'll be a grump, you'll be out of the changeling society. You no longer see these things or deal with these things. It'll kind of fade away. And so that inevitability that's kind of hardwired into Changeling the Dreaming contrasted with very Scooby-Doo, Buffy-style plot lines added an interesting friction that I wasn't anticipating, because it could have just been a flat, hey, we're having fun and the game's over, but it's the game's going to end, you know, at graduation, and we all know that's coming, and I'm not going to run anything more after this. So whatever you want to do, you got to get in the year. And so by having that limited one-year structure, it also bled into my portrayal of the character, because I was like, this is it. If I don't ask, my girlfriend out by prom or by graduation, it's over.
Right.
Stuff like that. And so I end up, even though I was, you know, much older than my teenage years, I've still felt that kind of tension and anxiety and melodrama in a way. And I think part of that was because of the nature of the setting and the nature of the game. So it's always, to me, great when people can take a really cool deep background, take some elements of it, and craft a very specific experience and let players play within that crafted experience. And that's one of the things I think Onyx Path does well, is because we do have these textured worlds, we can take games that don't, again, you know, you would never think necessarily to do that kind of game, you know, with Tangent and Dreaming, but it does work really well. You know, mm-hmm. you wouldn't necessarily think to have, you know, Dixon and I wouldn't necessarily think to have that kind of deep traumatic experience with Changing the Lost, but Matthew was able to play that. I think that that's a really strong approach.
Yeah, definitely. And like with talking about that, I mean, we're kind of going off about all these like gaming experiences. We haven't even introduced ourselves. I was wondering if anybody wanted to talk about like how we got into gaming, since we're already going through all these experiences.
We're a bunch of gamers, obviously.
Yeah, right. Hey, let's talk for 40 minutes about all these games that we really enjoyed playing. Also, you don't know who the hell I am.
Let me tell you about my character.
Oh God, yes. So I don't know, Eddie, did you want to talk a little bit about how you got into this?
Oh, absolutely, sure. I started, I actually been working on tabletop role-playing games as a friend, just for myself, since the 80s, but I was officially, came in, through 2002, worked on a game called Cartoon Action Hour, which was an 80s, action cartoon simulator, which I suppose in retrospect probably should have set the tone for my career, now that, you know, making something like Pugmire isn't that surprising, I suppose, when you hear that. But I actually was one of the last publishing hires for White Wolf in 2007, worked the company there. I ended up being what's called the alternative publishing developer. So I was the person that tried to make products in ways that weren't print a big book and put it in distribution. So I worked on PDFs, I worked on print on demand, I worked on smaller form things. We did some experiments with like embedding audio files in PDFs. Then I worked with Rich on the World Darkness MMO, but we still did tabletop stuff kind of within my workload. It's like, you know, 40 hours in the MMO, another 10 hours a week on tabletop stuff and the like. And so when Rich went off and formed Onyx Path Publishing around 2011, you know, I kept working with him, even though I was still with CCP, White Wolf at the time. I did freelance with him. I acted as a liaison between CCP and Onyx Path, because he trusted me to have his best interests in mind, and CCP had trusted me to have their best interests in mind. So it was a natural fit for me to kind of talk between the two. In there, I worked on Vampire the Masquerade 20th Anniversary Edition with Justin Achille, which was a great experience until he got another job in a different company. So I ended up kind of having to carry that across the line.
Right.
But it's interesting because, like, without going through my entire resume, a lot of my experience has been, you know, I'd find cool people to work with and work on a cool project. And then that led to something else, that led something else, led something else. So really a lot of it has been finding cool people and finding cool teams and working on amazing stuff. And now I have you guys as my next cool team that I get to work with.
I was going to say, are we a cool team?
You're the next cool team. In fact, you're my favorite cool team right now.
What?
Right now.
Yeah, I know.
You're a very fickle creature, now. Mr. Webb.
So, Matthew, I mean, I'm somewhat familiar with your career, but I don't know the details of it. How did you get involved in all this crazy stuff?
Well, whenever I start a tale, you can be sure that it's not going to be a quick one.
Are you going to make that sound every time?
Yeah. Ooh, it was in the year of etc. friends, Romans. Anyhow. So, I guess, well, I've been role-playing for quite some time, but actually writing for the industry, my first attempt to write role-playing games was I submitted for a contest, in fact, for a Vampire the Requiem Bloodlines book, Bloodlines the Chosen, as it was ultimately named. I did not get selected for that, and I harbored bitter resentment towards the industry furthermore. But luckily I got over that and submitted several more times. And this is something, if you're a listener, if you're interested in writing for the industry, absolutely be prepared that the first few submissions you send will receive no response. You might get an acknowledgement, say, yes, we've got this, but you probably won't get, this is what works, this is what doesn't, because there are quite a lot of submissions. And part of the knack, I guess, is diligence, it's improvement, it's recognizing what you did wrong the first time, and again, diligence. And so I had to submit a few times before I got hired. My first written work for Onyx Path was actually on Book of the Worm for Werewolf, the Apocalypse 20th Anniversary Edition, and that was just by being a backer of the Kickstarter. It wasn't paid work. I wanted the, I guess, role-playing equivalent of a creative writing class, and I thought the best way to do this is to back at an upper level, get in as a consulting developer, see how these books are developed, the kind of text they're looking for, the kind of, I guess, the kind of advice developers give their writers. And so I got to sit in on a book that Stu Wilson was developing and got to see how he develops a book. And as it happened, I learned a great deal from that, to the point that I sent him a submission. Well, I sent a submission to Onyx Path, and I said, Stu, I've sent this on. Would you care to look at it? And Stu gave me 5 minutes of his time. He reviewed it. He said, this is what's right. This is what's wrong. Do it again. And I did it again, and he was happy. And I said, would you mind if I wrote some directors for Pentex, the big antagonist organization in Werewolf the Apocalypse, because we didn't have those in Book of the Worm at the time. He said, sure, go for it. We had the word count. I did it. It got included. I was happy. Now, that's not going to be for everyone, because not everyone would see that as a legitimate way of accessing the industry. But my philosophy has always been that you pay for creative writing classes at college. You can pay, let's say, $1,000 to go on this many lessons and learn how to write this novel. For me, it was paying to get into the industry, and it didn't get me into the industry. It just got me to see how the machine worked. So then I submitted again, and it just so happened that the developer of Mummy the Curse saw my submission, which was for Mummy the Curse, and he hired me on a book called Sothis Ascends. This was back in 2013, I think. And that was my first paid gig. So that was 20,000 words on the era, which was the Foundation of Islam era. It was a pretty big first assignment, but I delivered it. There were barely any amendments. I was very happy with that by the end. And I can say that the reason that worked out for me was because I had, I guess, taken that step in the first place to actually see what do these people look for in their work. And it was a sneaky way of doing it, but it seems to have worked out all right, because now I'm the lead developer or in-house developer of Onyx Path's work on World of Darkness properties. And I don't think, Eddie, we've actually stated that you are the lead or in-house developer over the Onyx Path owned and
oh yeah, I should probably actually work in job title. So we're all in-house developers. That's kind of the conceit of all of this, is that all three of us are in-house developers for Onyx Path. As you're responsible for the World of Darkness, I'm responsible for pretty much everything else. I keep an eye on the creator-owned stuff. Obviously, the creators have a lot more say in things, so I'm just more kind of helping them out and giving them advice. But primarily, I'm looking at all the story path driven games. So, Trinity Continuum, Scion, our new licensed game, Dystopia Rising, and also I look over the 5e and Pathfinder games, so Scarred Lands. So, kind of everything else that's a bucket that either Onyx Path owns or uses Onyx Path's a personal house system is kind of what I'm responsible for. And Dixie, you cover what now?
I cover Chronicles of Darkness, which, I mean, I can list them all if you need me to.
There's a lot of them.
yeah. So all of the what used to be called New World of Darkness, now Chronicles of Darkness, includes, you know, Hunter the Vigil, Geist of Sin Eaters, Vampire the Requiem, Beast Primordial, the forthcoming Deviant the Renegades, and then also Exalted, which is its own beast. It is still licensed from White Wolf. But it's such a different line from a lot of our other lines that it ended up kind of falling under my purview. Actually, at the time of this recording, we have a Kickstarter going on. that is doing very well for our new Dragon Blooded book, which is super exciting.
And
hopefully that will continue to do well. But yeah, so I oversee all of those. Although my primary thing that I do here is editing. Whereas you two do a lot of development and writing still, I don't do a whole lot of development. I pretty much let my developers develop and I let my writers write. And I edit books from across all the game lines still. So, you know, Eddie might throw me Scion or Trinity projects. I'm probably going to end up doing The Game from Beneath the Sea. I just did Monarchies of Mao. Because when I came on, I was primarily an editor. Actually, I can talk about how I got into this. So when I was in high school, I'm going to go back a little bit. I never thought I would have a job in the industry. I never even thought that those jobs existed on some level. I don't think I ever looked at the credits pages of the books I was using to play. I think they just, you know.
They just come from the ether.
Yeah, they just like sprang fully formed from the head of Dracula. I started playing World of Darkness games when I was probably 15 or 16, playing a lot of Vampire the Masquerade with the other weird goth kids at my high school. Because, you know, that's what we did. Like,
of course.
We're not quite nerdy enough to play D&D, but we were definitely giant nerds. So we played a lot of World of Darkness games. We also played a lot of, like, In Nomine and other just kind of horror-ish games, which was cool.
Nice.
And then when I went to school, I went to school for composition and rhetoric, English major. And I edited the school paper for a few years, and getting into editing was something I really wanted. Just so happens that I used to live in Atlanta, and from that I knew Rose Bailey and some of the other White Wolf CCP folks. And so when I was out job hunting, Rose kind of said, like, I could actually use another editor, you know? Let me give you a small project and see how you do, which was the Demon Translation Guide, so the guide for importing the two Demon games into each other, if you want to. And I guess everybody liked my work on that. So the next book I got was the second edition Chronicles of Darkness core rulebook, which included the updated God Machine Chronicle. And I was kind of like, oh, I don't know much about this, because I hadn't really played a whole lot of New World of Darkness at the time. But I learned, and I learned on my feet, like we all do on these jobs. Yes. I feel like half of this job is me going to people like Eddie and Matthew and you two coming to me and us going like, I don't know how to do this. What's this? And then we all kind of help each other and figure it out as we go.
Absolutely.
So I still primarily edit, although I edit now while constantly answering emails and making spreadsheets. It's very exciting.
Let's talk about some of our upcoming releases. I know we're approaching the hour mark, and we probably don't want to go too far beyond that on our first podcast, but let's talk about some of the releases that are upcoming, hopefully in the next few months, at the very least by the end of 2018, or the very latest, I should say. That's going to get Rich throttling me to death, isn't it? And the fact I've now said that these books will definitely be out by the end of 2000. I did not say that, Rich. I didn't. I never put a single date down.
No, never happened.
I nebulously said these books might one day come out within this year, perhaps, but possibly not. And that's the thing. We're very laissez-faire with these things.
Well, not that laissez-faire, because books need to get out the door, exactly. So it's on.
In fact, that's something worth covering in a future podcast. If people are interested to hear, it's the production schedule. These books that we make, it is more than just writing them, editing them, inputting the art, and then publishing them. And even that is probably more complex than some people have messaged me and said, isn't this just a case of writing it, getting a few drawings put in, and, you know, going to a publisher asking it? They forget the editing stage completely. If you're good enough writers, you don't need an editor, they tell me. Congratulations, Dixie.
That is so wrong.
No. I don't like that at all.
But yeah, everyone needs an editor. Upcoming releases we have, maybe this, hopefully it'll be kickstarted this year at the very least, is the Contagion Chronicle. And the Contagion Chronicle is the big crossover book for Chronicles of Darkness. Now, crossover is something mm-hmm. of a bugbear, I guess. In World of Darkness, it was always incredibly difficult because in World of Darkness, the vampires and werewolves don't get on. Mages don't have a great deal of, don't really have much reason to speak to or work with such parasitical creatures as vampires. And I've always thought that the closest crossover you could get seamlessly was vampire and wraith, if you're playing the right vampire clans, or changeling and mage.
Right.
But I guess any of them were interchangeable. It's just very difficult without a shoehorn to make a vampire, a werewolf, a mage, a changeling, a wraith all go to a party together. But that's why we have Monty Cook's World of Darkness. Moving on, we have Chronicles of Darkness. And Chronicles of Darkness is a lot more crossover friendly. We don't have any set in stone antagonisms between the lines. What we need are reasons for them to work together rather than reasons to explain they're not working together. And that's what the Contagion Chronicle is. Contagion Chronicle is a big right. book that contains, in part, a plot or series of plots, lots of different story hooks. I'm very big on story hooks in the books I develop and write, that give reasons for these characters to work together, but also to mm-hmm. complement each other in their working together. So, yeah, fair enough. A vampire and a mage hang out on the same street corner, but what does that mean for them mechanically? And Contagion Chronicle goes some way to answering this, because the, I guess, external threat of Contagion Chronicle, and internal in some cases, is this eponymous contagion. It's something that's eroding the supernatural structure of the Chronicles of Darkness world. It's changing the fundamentals. And whether that means that the blood in your favoured vessel is starting to taste like battery acid if you're a vampire, or the werewolf you know from down the street just cannot stop changing shape and lashing out and ripping people to shreds, something is fundamentally wrong. And you can tune this all the way up to 11 if you want, or you can turn it all the way down to 1 and make it a deeply subtle threat. But the contagion is something that only our supernatural creatures are capable of interacting with and witnessing. And that extends to hunters as well, because they are considered touched by the supernatural. They are aware of this, hence they can identify vampires a little more readily than the average mortal on the street. Now, Contagion Chronicle has these pacts, these factions, by the name of the Sworn. These are different groups of vampires, werewolves, mages, etc., that band together for different reasons. And largely they gravitate around the contagion, but they have other reasons for working together as well. And as a reward for those of you who have stuck with the podcast for this long, I will read out one of these Sworn Factions write-ups. Now, these write-ups have been written by Megan Fitzgerald, which is timely, because we have her as our first guest. And one of the first factions mm-hmm. that she has written up is the Cryptocracy, which is a name I love. And each of these Sworn Factions sees the contagion as a different, I guess, form of corruption. The Cryptocracy, for instance, sees the contagion as social entropy, whereas we have later on the Jeremiad, who sees contagion as divine retribution. And then we have the Rosetta Society, who believe the contagion is a message, perhaps from an alternate dimension or universe, and so on. But the Cryptocracy, they say to you, look around you. World leaders hold each other hostage, poised to rain nuclear death down on all of us, human or not, in a fit of pique. People wear their hatred for each other on their sleeves, proud to be selfish warmongers as they close their borders, arm their citizens and wave their dicks around. They watch the planet tear itself apart and pretend everything is fine. Sometimes we get self-absorbed too, and we stop paying much attention to what the mortals are doing. That bites us in the ass every time. The contagion is what happens when humanity slides too far down the spiral into atrocity and unrest. It's only logical. Blood spills, society breaks down, the world gets sick. Then the effects make everything worse and throw us all into this maddening feedback loop that threatens to dismantle civilization altogether. Once humanity gets its collective shit back together, the outbreak subsides and we can all get back to our nightly blood-sucking or obsessing over esoterica or whatever it is we normally do, at least until it all happens again. The cryptocracy believe they stand to lose stability and comfort if they let the contagion that exists in the world run rampant. They like the stability. They like having control. These are the supernatural creatures that want to remain on top, and they love the status quo, because without it, with chaos, they stand to lose everything. And what they stand to gain, they believe they stand to gain greater control. If they can weaponize contagion, if they can make it their own, they can truly harness the true powers of the world, both ephemeral and tangible. So each of these sworn factions has its own history section. It has the ways in which the sworn faction works together, and also contains the most likely types of creatures to inhabit a sworn faction such as this. So the cryptocracy, for instance, is likely to have Invictus vampires, Guardians of the Veil, the Oogaloo beasts, and Winter courtiers from Changeling, Markep mummies. They will all work together because they all have this central, fundamental concept. They enjoy control. They enjoy status quo. And hopefully, by that description, if you're familiar with Chronicles of Darkness and you're wondering, why would my Markep work with an Invictus vampire? It's not because they have shared supernatural origins, necessarily. It's not because they are both obsessed with Duap. They're not. It's not because they're both obsessed with blood. They're not. They're both obsessed with control. And control of information, control of perception, and the cryptocracy, therefore, is a faction on a faction. And that's what Contagion Chronicle does. It gives these templates, these Vampire Invictus, this Markep mummy, it gives them an additional template, a sworn template. And Eddie, should I go into... in fact, I'll pass it over to you. Could you explain briefly for people interested in the Contagion Chronicle what the vectors are?
Yeah, sure. So Matthew asked me and a couple other freelancers to kind of work out the powers that the Sworn get. And he initially had some ideas, but as we started digging in and chatting, we realized that it wasn't quite panning out, because there was some form of, well, I already have this power. And that was the thing we kept running into. It's like, well, vampires already have mesmerism. Why do I get mesmerism? You know, do we make that more powerful? And so I started pitching the idea of what I call vectors, which are that it's both a vector in the sense of a disease vector, because it plays well with the contagion terminology, but also a vector of approach. How do you solve this problem? And then once we'd nailed that down, it kind of fell into place, because Matthew mentioned these write-ups have the what we do section of it, and why these sworn get together, that it became kind of a natural approach of they use that power or that ideological approach to attack the contagion. So using the cryptocracy, I developed the authority vector. They are obsessed with power, and so they use that acquisition of power to solve the problem. And so it's lots of things like they have the ability to tap into surveillance networks. They have the ability to walk into a scene and everyone assumes that they're in charge. All different variations on authority. So rather than a staggered, I'm now slightly better at being a telepath than I was previously, it's all kind of more of a grab bag of powers, but they all play off the central theme that ties in directly to what the Sworn do. So a lot of other powers in Chronicles of Darkness are some form of, this is what I am and right. What I can do. This is, and so with vectors, it's more, this is what I do and how I do it better. But the other thing that's interesting that I was surprised it worked out well is that individual characters don't have vectors. The group has vectors. They all buy into the vector. So it becomes kind of a group merit, for lack of a better term. So if we are a group of cryptocrats, which is a great word, and we're all working together in authority and we all buy into authority, then we all share that authority power. And if one of you leaves the sworn, you no longer have access to that vector because you're no longer part of the group. So it encourages characters to keep working together because now you have access to powers that you've invested in. So I have to keep working with this group of knuckleheads if I want to keep using my cool powers.
I think you're going to have a lot of fun editing that, Dixie.
Knuckleheads is going to be there a lot.
I'm going to have the most fun. Yeah, I don't know. I enjoy editing new systems and things like that when trying to figure out how the language works and make sure it's communicated clearly. I think that's one of the things that I sometimes have as an advantage as an editor, is that half the time when I'm editing something, I'm seeing it for the very first time. I haven't stared at it 18 times or reviewed it mm-hmm. a million times or whatever. So not only do I catch typos, but I also tend to catch things where I'm like, I don't understand this. Like, the mm-hmm. sentence doesn't make sense if I were reading it as a player. So that's like a, you know, helpful thing to have on a lot of these projects or new eyes. So although I enjoy following projects from start to finish, like I'm in the Slack for Contagion Chronicle, for instance, I'm actually not reading a whole lot of the documents. I'm kind of just going like, okay, this is under control. Like, I'll see this later when it's ready. Because I also don't want to confuse myself on new lines.
Well, the team, right. We've been using Slack, which, if you're unfamiliar with it, is a communal, I guess, chat and working software. Some people use Google Groups, some people use Facebook Groups. We're using Slack, and I found it's been incredibly helpful. The team we have on Contagion, not to blow their trumpets too much, but I guess as their developer I should, has been absolutely fantastic in the way they've been collaborating. And I can say this knowing that Eddie is on that absolutely. Team, and obviously I am mm-hmm. because I'm developing, and as Dixie says, she does have oversight because Chronicles of Darkness is her purview. So the writers, Eddie as well, well, as one of them, have been wonderful. Not only are they exchanging ideas, they are also reading through each other's work and offering constructive criticism and compliments. And that's such a wonderful thing mm-hmm. to see on a project, because you don't get it on all books. You need the right team and you need the right project to warrant it. But given the potential complexity of a book containing vampires, werewolves, mages, Prometheans, geists, changelings, and I could go on, but I won't. You need a big team, because you need people who know at least two games each. That was part of my rule for working on this book. Yep. You needed to have read at least two of the rule books and confirm back to me that you have. I gave the writers time in advance to read if they hadn't. Not only do you know the game, you also know how it works mechanically, and you can have some idea of how these mechanics can jive with the other Chronicles of Darkness lines. So everyone has been on the same page throughout. I'm also very fortunate I've had no writers drop, and writers do so all the time for perfectly legitimate reasons. But mm-hmm. when you've got a book this big with a team with no writers that have to cry off at some point because of some perfectly legitimate reason, it makes work so much easier. Yeah. And actually, Dixie, something you mm-hmm. mentioned about being able to see this, well, looking at these books with a fresh pair of eyes, I guess, really right. helps with the editing process. I can speak to the, I guess, counter to that, that I've been working on one game since the middle of last year. It's not an Onyx Path one, but it's very easy to get snowblind, I guess, to the content you're working with, to suddenly have it stop making sense in your mind because you're thinking, what am I doing now?
Right.
And so you have to take a break and you have to move on to other projects. It's been one of the best things about taking on this role with Onyx Path is I now have innumerable projects that I can look at. If I get tired of Werewolf, I can look at Mage. If I get tired of Mage, I can look at Wraith. So that's good.
And that's actually something that kind of tying it back to Weathered Onyx Path and Rich Thomas specifically, that's one thing that Rich is particularly good about, is he recognizes that a lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people need that kind of palate cleanser. And so he's encouraged all of us to take on work outside of Onyx Path, because from his perspective, we get a fresh perspective on a different company. And also sometimes we might learn something that we can then bring back to our Onyx Path work and improve. So we're not, he isn't expecting us to put the nose to the grindstone and work on the same thing for, years and years and years and years. It's the, it's pick a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And he encourages, certainly he enjoys, and respects, expertise. And it's like, you really understand this line very well. That's obviously valuable, but being able to look at something that's very different and then bring it back. It's one of the reasons why I liked working on Pugmire, because it was just a break from, bastard colored bastards doing bastard things to each other all the time. It's like, oh, hey, they'd be slightly nice. Okay, back to bastards. Here we go. You know, but it does, you're right. It does bring a little, a breath of fresh air, and also just allows you to kind of clear your mind, not think about another project for a while, and come back and go, oh, okay, this thing just jumps out at you. Wow, that was, why didn't I see it the first time around?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, like, for me, like, this is now my day job, and then I still do freelancing projects at night. And then also for a lot of our writers and developers, they have, you know, quote unquote, actual, like, office type day jobs.
Right.
And then they come and do this at night. And so I try to tell people sometimes, you know, like, take free time if you need to, like, take the night off. Like, we've mentioned Megan a few times, like, her day job is working at NASA. And then at night she comes home and she works on Exalted and she works on Changeling and she does other things. And every now and then, like, she's worked on other lines for other companies too. And so every now and then I'll look at some of these folks and be like, how are you doing this? Because my days are all role-playing all the time, it seems like. Like, I work on XPath stuff during the day, then I might work on a Fantasy Flight project at night, or a project for Darker Hue Studios or something. And so it's just been a lot of, like, I have to make myself take time off, too.
Yeah.
And kind of just because after a while, like, there's only so much I can edit during one day before my eyes start crossing. And I start missing stuff.
Honestly, I think that could be an entire episode of just talking about what it's like to be a freelance developer, because we are contractors, we're not employees, and that does change the relationship and also changes how we approach work. But that's a really deep topic that I think is probably worth digging into in a separate episode.
Oh, definitely.
So, with that said, we're 1 hour 10 minutes into this inaugural epic. Do we have anything particularly pressing or pertinent to add before we sign off and thank everyone who has stuck with us for listening thus far?
I think we'll...
Dixie, anything from you?
Nothing particularly pressing. If this goes up in the next, you know, little bit here, then check out the Dragonblooded Kickstarter for Exalted 3rd Edition, because it's going to be awesome.
Yes, please, everyone, check that out, because that book is looking beautiful, both in text and art. And I'm not, I'm self-confessed, not even the biggest Exalted fan. But Dragonblooded was my favorite. I got into Exalted as second edition, and Dragonblooded was my favorite then for obvious reasons. And now seeing the third edition as well, I'm all woo. You know, I'm just enjoying seeing this come together, and also the enthusiasm for this book and the Kickstarter comments is excellent to see.
Absolutely,
very much. Eddie, anything?
What about you, Eddie?
Honestly, I was just going to say that I'm really looking forward to where this podcast goes. I mean, I think that I do enjoy chatting with you guys anyway, and being able to kind of capture some of the cool conversations we've been having over the past couple of months, and letting other people listen to them and offer us other interesting things to talk about. I'm just really looking forward to that.
And as we haven't discussed anything wrestling-based, we have set ourselves up with a little mandate to mention wrestling at least once per podcast.
Oh,
Eddie,
no.
Are you going to be watching WrestleMania live?
I am, but I'll be honest, the build-up for WrestleMania has been a little tepid for me this year. There's some interesting matches on the card, but it's... I'm just not as like, oh my god, can't wait to see this. I mean, there's a couple of matches I'm curious about. I got the Shinsuke Nakamura match, just because a huge fan of his, but we'll see. I mean, I think it'd be fun. I'm looking forward to it, but just not as excited about it as I've been in previous years.
Yeah, I think the 7-hour show that now exists as WrestleMania is a little too much for me now. I prefer to watch the shorter ones. But anyway, wrestling, that's an episode in its own right, but we'll mention something wrestling.
No, it's not.
we'll educate you, Dixie, whether you like it or not. You will be educated.
No, and in that case, I want a whole episode about Sailor Moon. Are you just gonna talk about Sailor Moon?
Done. Let's do it.
I'm an hour and a half.
I can talk about that too.
Yeah, I am almost completely oblivious to most anime and manga. I do own some mangas in the sense I own the
manga.
Comics. Manga. Well, there you go. I'm English. We invented the word manga, I'm sure. I'll tell you how to damn well pronounce it. beyond that, yeah, I'm likewise excited to see where this podcast goes. Some people listening to this will be familiar with the fact that I've got a YouTube channel called The Gentleman Gamer. We'll start publicizing the ways of contacting us very, very soon. But it's always nice to put yourself out in a medium where you can interact with other people that enjoy the same thing as you do. And we do really want people that listen to this to post on the Onyx Path forum, post on the blog, theonyxpath.com, and wherever else you like to post things, to let us know your thoughts regarding this podcast, any subjects you want us to cover. We can't guarantee we'll cover all of them, but we can certainly read your comments and hopefully give you a little bit of interaction, because we are genuinely appreciative of the time you're giving us right now.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
With that said, you can contact me if you want to, and by all means you're able to, on Twitter at @clackclickbang, and on the Onyx Path forum as The Gentleman Gamer, or on YouTube as The Gentleman Gamer. Eddie?
You can find me just about any social media website by looking for Eddie Fate, EddyFate, or you can go to my website, eddyfate.com.
And for me, you can find me on most social media at Dixie Cyanide. That's Dixie like my first name, Cyanide like the poison. That's also my name on the Onyx Path forums. And also, just for the future, when we do interviews, we are going to try to post threads there if you want to ask questions of the people that we'll be interviewing. So keep an eye out for that as well.
Yeah, good idea. And also, we should probably, yeah, we should maybe come up with some kind of schedule of podcast topics, shouldn't we, so we're not going in blind. But you know, that's the sort of thing professionals do, and we are pretty damn far from that,
right? So we're not gonna do that.
We're just contractors.
So, exactly, that's what we'll try. What have you been doing with my time? Hey, you contract people.
Yeah, billable, yeah, hours, man.
Yeah, we pay for
writing our new Sailor Moon wrestling game crossover.
What is happening on my podcast?
So with that said, thank you very much, everyone, for listening. And so this has been the Onyx Pathcast. Many worlds, one podcast.